I welcome everyone back to another edition of New Books in Education on the New Books Network. This is your host, Ryan Allen, and I'm very excited today to have on with me Dr. Leslie Grant, who is Assistant Professor of Education at the School of Education, the College of William and Mary. And we're going to be looking at her book called West Meets East, Best Practices from Expert Teachers in the United States and China. And this is from ASCD, and this was published in 2014. So I'm very excited to bring this on. I have an interest in China myself, and I think it's always interesting to sort of see these two education systems that you might think are very different, but then maybe you'd be surprised to see some similarities. So, Dr. Grant, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Ryan. I'm just delighted to be asked to talk about the book. It was certainly a long term and quite interesting project, and something that my colleagues and I are deeply interested in, and that is what are the beliefs and characteristics of teachers, and do some of those beliefs and characteristics cross the cultural divide between the United States and China. So we're delighted to share what we learned with folks through the publication of our book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the interesting factors of this book, I think, is the collaboration with yourself and the several other authors. And can you maybe talk about how that collaboration came together and how this project came to be?
Sure. Well, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, I'm an assistant professor at the College of William and Mary. And before that, just to share, I was a middle school social studies teacher. So I taught middle school for about 10 years and then worked for the California Testing Bureau, CTB McGraw-Hill, developing state customized assessments. I continued that work in terms of curriculum alignment and looking at assessments. But then when I was in my doctoral studies, became very interested in what are those characteristics that make good teachers good, so essentially effective teaching. And during the time, and this was after I completed my doctoral degree, we launched a study on expert teachers in the United States, so teachers who had won national awards for their teaching in the United States. And this was collaboration among myself, Dr. James Strong at the College of William & Mary, and Dr. Catherine Little, who is a professor, associate professor at the University of Connecticut. And so we launched this study looking at great teachers in the United States. Then we had the great fortune of having a visiting scholar from Yunnan Normal University in Kunming, which is in the Yunnan province of China, come and study with us for about 4 or 5 months. And during that time, realized that we had similar interest in looking at what makes great teachers great. And so we launched a cross-cultural comparative study looking at teachers who, because the Ministry of Education also awards national awards for their teachers. And so did some comparisons, of course, on effective frameworks of teaching across the U.S. and China. We refined our research protocol, interview, and observation protocols that we used, and then launched a cross-cultural comparative study. During that time, also, we were engaged in a similar study with our colleague, Dr. Patricia Pop, who is head of our Project HOPE, which focuses on homeless education. We were interested in great teachers who work with at-risk and highly mobile students. And so she entered the study as well. And then finally, Dr. Xinchuan Xu was a doctoral student at the College of William & Mary. And again, she was also interested in this topic, so she was involved as well. And so we just had the great fortune, if you can imagine, observing and interviewing teachers who have won national awards for their teaching. It's quite exciting. And so we were able to travel across the U.S. In many different geographic locations, as well as some schools that were urban, suburban, and rural, different levels of teaching, so elementary, middle, and high, and the same in China. We were across the country in China in different provinces, elementary, middle, and high, different content areas, as well as some that were right in the heart of a city and some schools that were out in the countryside. And so there was a real purpose in getting this variation because we used a sampling technique called maximum variation sampling, where when you have a small number of cases, if you use maximum variation sampling and you have something that bubbles up in terms of a commonality, well, then there just might be something there. So we were just delighted to be able to carry through with the study, and it really did take this team of folks to pull the study together, as you can imagine, coordinating planning for the visits and then the follow-up in terms of translating. And we used a technique called back translation to ensure that we were both looking at the data in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that is, I think, you guys highlight that nicely, that you're not just sort of sometimes they say you do research by convenience. You know, you're in this one city and you just go and see the teachers in that city, or you know someone in the school, so you just use that school. You do really get a nice, diverse group of teachers in both the United States and in China. So that's really refreshing. So when you set out to write this project or to work on this project, and it kind of came together, who were you kind of hoping that would be reading this book or that would be interested in this book?
Sure. Well, what we've found certainly is that educators across the U.S. Are interested in what's happening in China, where we're getting these really high PISA scores. Mm-hmm. And certainly international comparisons are front page news in the United States, where Shanghai, the first year that Shanghai participated in PISA, they were number one. And of course, the comparisons of PISA, you know, you have cities in China compared to the whole country of the United States. And so educators, and that means classroom teachers as well as those who work in policy, are interested in what's happening there. How is their education system similar to or different from, and what can we learn from them? We know from previous studies, such as the TIMSS study, where they looked at, you know, how is mathematics approached differently, where in the U.S. we focus more on procedural understanding, and in the East Asian countries that perform very well, they focus more on conceptual understanding of mathematics. So folks are interested in how is it that children are educated. And then in China, what's interesting is there, you know, where we're moving more toward in the U.S., you know, over the past 20 years, a standardized assessment movement. In China, even though it's ingrained in their culture since those first imperial examinations many, many centuries ago, that they're thinking about and looking at how do we embed or encourage creativity, innovation. And so getting really high PISA scores, but then how do we encourage students to or develop that intellectual curiosity and that capacity to develop something wholly new? Mm-hmm. So China's interested in that. So here we are on two ends of a continuum, if you will, in terms of a standardized assessment movement, which China's educational system is firmly grounded in terms of high stakes testing and examinations. And we have the U.S. where we have, you know, the most number of patents of any country in the world. In terms of that, we've also been engaged in another study, which I'll talk about later, looking at cultural dimensions and patents and economic productivity. And so here we have, you know, a country that has, you know, where you do have innovation and creativity. And so China's looking at that and what we can do or what they can do in China to foster that in their educational system. And so educators, both in the classroom teachers, have been highly interested in our study, as well as those who are looking at policy and folks who are also studying this issue in higher education.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is, when you just go through it, almost like when you are reading it, just you can see that these best practices and maybe can give people some sort of guidance if they're sort of looking for something, even if just in their classroom. You know, I teach at a small university, so I was thinking, oh, you know, can I even incorporate, or do I do something similar to this? I kept finding myself going back to that mindset as well. So, yeah, I think it's a wide range of interests for people interested in education, policy, and cross-cultural studies, certainly, and China, obviously. So let's go ahead and maybe get into some of the meat of the book.
Sure.
Kind of already talked about the introduction, but you kind of lay it out. Chapter two, we get into teachers' personal qualities and sort of the relationship with students. What was interesting that you found in that chapter, and maybe are there any similarities, or what are the main differences? Can you kind of get into that?
Absolutely. Well, interestingly, and we had, you know, some findings that were surprising to us in our study. And interestingly, the relationships with students was a very strong similarity between teachers in the U.S. and China, where they valued their relationships with their students and saw their relationships as necessary to help kids learn. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the affective crossed or overlapped with the academic. And we actually even observed that when we were observing in different countries. And when I would be in a classroom in China, and I do not speak Chinese, we had a translator who speaks Mandarin with us. Mm-hmm. And as you know, you can walk into a classroom without knowing the language and get a feel for the climate of the relationship between the teachers and the students. And I can remember in one teacher, he was teaching physics, ninth grade. And, you know, as the kids were coming in, he was greeting them. He was, you know, putting his hand on their shoulder and talking with them, how are they doing? Mm-hmm. And they were responding very positively. And you just can't fake something like that. That just can't be, you know, a show that's put on for one day. That very positive relationships with their students. And that was a theme that ran across U.S. teachers as well as across teachers in China. But there was a bit of a difference in terms of the relationship in that with teachers in the U.S., it was that, you know, I'm a teacher. It's important to have a relationship with my student. And so it is important that I get to know him or her on their level. What do they like to do? What are they interested in, so that I can then incorporate that into my lesson. So a child's interested in soccer. Well, let's find the area and perimeter of a soccer field. You know, so things like that to integrate into their instruction. Whereas the teachers in China talked more about their students as family, such as he's my son. I love him like love her like my daughter. I'm their mother. I'm their brother, I'm their sister, and so used more familial terms to describe their relationships with their students. It's not to say we had U.S. teachers who said that they love their children, but very few described their relationships in terms of a family type of relationship, whereas in China, they certainly did. And so that was a bit of a difference in terms of the relationship with their students, but both really saw their relationship. And again, we had that confirmed when we were in there observing their teaching.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Very good. And, you know, maybe that helps us break the mold, if you will, for sort of a stereotype of maybe like the Chinese teacher as this sort of robotic automaton.
Right.
Yeah.
So, not at all. I mean, I can't imagine any teacher that we observed was in that way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so, yeah.
Okay, that's very very good to see on paper as well. Okay, so how about something that's, I know, sort of a hot button issue in the United States, but going right along, looking at assessment and how teachers sort of assess themselves, and then also you know, talk about planning in that lesson as well. What were some interesting findings from this category?
From the planning category in terms of, yeah. So planning was really quite interesting. In the U.S., many teachers talked about how that they, you know, the process that they go through in planning instruction, where you look at your standards, you look at curriculum materials, and you plan. But the process might have been slightly different. In fact, we had a few teachers who said, you know, I really don't plan very specifically, and I allow for a lot of flexibility. Mm-hmm. But in China, we had, there was, and this is a theme that honestly emerged across the categories, where if you can imagine such a large country with such an incredible population, that we saw great commonality across China teachers across the country. More commonality than we saw across U.S. teachers across the United States. So when we would talk about planning, most of the teachers talked about approaching planning in terms of what are the key knowledge points that kids needed to know, those enduring understandings, what were the key difficult points that kids would encounter, and how do I plan my lesson so that indeed I'm going to anticipate what are the troubling areas that kids might have.
Right.
And so that, you know, it was interesting to hear these three key points talked about across China. You know, we were in many different provinces and in the countryside, but this was obviously something that was stressed perhaps in their preparation as well as in professional development. Versus in the U.S., it was more varied in terms of how the teachers go about planning. Now, all of them talked about, of course, standards and needing to adhere to that. But again, it was interesting that commonality across China teachers. And with the assessment piece, and how do you use, you know, one of the big pushes in education today, of course, is using assessments to drive your instruction, to plan and adjust instruction according to student needs. Whereas U.S. teachers, some talked about assessing students and then using that in their planning. So how is it that students performed on this assessment, whether it's a, you know, regular quiz or test or even something like what we call an exit card, where you give students a problem to do before they leave class, and you look at that and think, what am I going to do differently tomorrow? Where they adjusted their lessons based on what we might call pre-assessment data, which is, or diagnostic kind of data. You know, where are kids right now and what do they need? Whereas in China, there wasn't really the pre-assessment or diagnostic. It was, over the courses of the years as a teacher, where do I know that kids are typically going to struggle? Not necessarily, where are my kids within my classroom right now, and how are they performing according to what we're going to be learning? And so that was the difference in terms of using assessment in order to drive instruction.
Right. And you kind of mentioned a little bit sort of different systems, so one central, one decentralized.
Yes.
Was there any concern? You know, because I think when you asked the teachers, most of the American teachers said that they had they were afforded a lot of creativity when coming up with these lessons. I'm just curious if they felt there was any sort of outside pressure to sort of change that a little bit. I know that's a little bit off, but when we're talking, it seems like maybe it might have came
up. Absolutely. I think, and certainly we know that one of the unintended consequences of standardized assessment and the standards-based reform efforts over the past 20 or so years is that teachers have felt that it hampered their creativity. Mm-hmm. But what I will say is these great teachers do not necessarily see standards as impacting necessarily how they go about teaching. So the standards, of course, lay out what it is that kids should know and be able to do, but not necessarily how me as a teacher, how I need to teach in my classroom. So they certainly used creative ways to address different topics. For example, one U.S. teacher was using fantasy football to teach statistics. So, you know, we think about that in terms of a, you know, creative use, something of high interest to kids, and you're getting at key knowledge and skills that are contained in the standard. So, you know, these great teachers in the U.S. certainly found ways to incorporate creativity and high interest, high engaging activities into the classroom.
Absolutely. And that feeds right into, I think, the next section of the book very nicely. You know, what are the, you know, these teachers do get awards, you know, they are great, but what are they doing in the classroom? Why are they exceptional? What did you find that just along the lines every teacher was doing this, and that maybe some other differences as well?
Sure. Well, of course, one of the differences, when we went in and we observed the teachers, we had a protocol that we used where we collected data. Mm-hmm. And we collected data on the different instructional activities that they were using in the classroom. We also collected data on the cognitive levels of those various activities. So are they working at lower cognitive levels or higher cognitive levels? And those are actually more defined than lower and higher. And then we also looked at the engagement of the students. And so one commonality that emerged was that these teachers used about 8 to 9 different instructional activities during a lesson. Now, those 8 or 9 were different between the U.S. and China.
Right.
But the key is that they used different instructional activities. And what that means is that there wasn't where a teacher was getting up and just lecturing for the entire time. Mm-hmm. That might lecture, especially in China, might give a short lecture, then kids are working on something independently, then they might be working on something as a group, then I'm going to call them back together for question and answer, and those types of things. And so both sets of teachers used varied instructional activities. And certainly I think that led to that impacts engagement. In addition, we found the range of cognitive levels, and that was a similarity where, at various times students, of course, having to recall, working on understanding concepts, application of skills, and then analysis. And across both teachers, we found less of evaluation and create, which is common. Mm-hmm. You see that certainly across other studies as well. And then another similarity was that in all teachers' classrooms, there was extremely high engagement. Mm. And so how we measured that, now, of course, it's more of like a time on task or, you know, on task kind of behaviors. And so we would scan the room and look to see were there any off-task behaviors, and we calculate a percentage. And certainly, you know, a student can be looking at the teacher and nodding and be off task, but we can't be in their head at the time.
Right.
Visually, it looks as though they are on task. And so across all the teachers, we have very high engagement. Now, you might say, well, you know, that makes sense in China. And that's true because it is, you know, one finding that we came out of this with is, you know, in the U.S., teachers are expected to engage their students. When we talk about what can you do as a teacher, and I taught in teacher preparation program as well, and now I teach in educational leadership, what can you do to engage your students? And that's something that we talk about frequently when working with our student teachers as well as teachers in the classroom right now. In China, it is the student's responsibility to be engaged.
Okay.
And so it's just a different dynamic.
Right.
And so, yes, I would have expected in China that kids would be engaged because that is an expectation of them culturally, that they go in to learn, that they respect their teachers, And we saw that. Now, we did see just a few instances of off-task behavior, but certainly it was high engagement across. But also in U.S., it was very high engagement, where it is the teacher's responsibility to engage.
Right.
So we saw that across both.
Okay. Yeah, and again, I think maybe, again, shattering the stereotypes of the Chinese teacher just standing up there and lecturing and pounding it in the student's head, you know, we can see that there's another way, or there's something more to the system than that simple stereotype, which, you know, I think is great.
Yeah, and I can give you a couple of examples,
sure.
Actually, in China, where we were in a first grade classroom, and if you can imagine, I think there were about 46 six-year-olds in the classroom. And I think we wrote about this in the book,
mm-hmm.
And the teacher, we went on a field trip.
Right.
Took the 46 first graders around the corner and walked over to the market. Each of them had 5 yen to spend.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went to the market and they picked out what they were going to purchase. And they purchased it. They had to save their receipt. And then they came back to the classroom, and it was really looking at Chinese language and when you're buying things in a store and going to the market. So really an authentic learning experience for children.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, great example. Another one was, you know, a physics teacher who had kids engaged in experiments to see lift, how that occurs. And so they were in small groups. They had lab equipment with them, and they had made these planes out of paper, and they were exploring this concept of lift.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's not the teacher standing up in front of the kids lecturing the entire time. I don't think when the teachers that I observed in China, that just didn't happen. Now, they would give short bursts of lecture,
sure.
So a 5 to 10 minute, and then move on to a small group activity or what have you. But that's a similar way that U.S. teachers do it as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, you talk about quite a bit throughout the book, and you highlighted, I think, with the lessons, but, you know, the numbers of students that are in the classes.
Yes.
You know, I think one, you mentioned 50, you just mentioned about 46. You know, if you know, that's one of the biggest complaints I think teachers in America have, is that their classrooms are being bloated and there's no way to sort of be able to teach these. But in the reality in China is that, you know, they have to do this just, you know, with the sheer numbers. Which is incredible, especially, and there's some great lessons that maybe can be learned and can be shared with our, you know, American teachers over here as well.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, when I present in front of groups, I have a picture of a first grade classroom in the U.S. side by side with a first grade classroom in China.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference is vast, just in terms of, you know, you have tables and chairs and colorful carpets and all that in the U.S., whereas in China it was rows and small stools that the children sat on. And so certainly the size is important. Now, I think that if you're a good teacher with 40 students, you can probably be an even greater teacher with 25.
Right.
However, you know, one of the things that has come out in research over the years in the U.S., is that reducing class size is not necessarily going to improve student achievement, that it is the teacher that the child happens to get.
Yeah.
Because you can be a really great teacher with 25 or 15, but if you're a poor teacher, you're going to be a poor teacher with 25 or 15.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, you know, when you get into the numbers of 40s and 50s, that certainly can impact your ability to work one-on-one with students. But certainly how they have managed that is something of interest.
Right. And I think that's one of the things that you found that were different, where the American teachers were more opted to work one-on-one at times, whereas maybe that's not a reality with the China-based teachers.
Yeah, one of the things that we coded was teacher working with individual students. And so we saw more of that in the U.S., and most likely because they just could.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas China teachers would go around and talk with groups of students, which that makes sense considering
right.
the number that you have. And so, yes, you did see more one-on-one discussion in the U.S.
Okay. Well, I guess, again, all of these things are very connected. But talking about sort of management style of the classroom, I think this is, you know, again, all of these things we can learn some lessons from. So what were some of the differences that you saw, and maybe even like with some of the, you know, the disciplinary actions, things like what did you guys find?
Well, you know, when we asked the question about classroom management, we got and how you organize the classroom and things like that. We actually got a lot more discussion from U.S. teachers than China teachers. Mm-hmm. It's just not something that that these teachers were concerned about. Mm-hmm. They did talk about how they might use the physical space, but you have to remember they're limited in terms of the numbers of students and how to set up the classroom. In addition, whereas in the U.S., I might have my classroom, and this is where my kids come. In China, it would more be the teacher that would move. And so their classroom, it wasn't their classroom. Mm-hmm. And so they had to come in, you know, into a classroom where the kids are and to teach. And so, you know, they talked about how that, you know, it is the students that they expect them to pay attention and to learn. And that it is the students, indeed, one teacher shared with us, it's the students' moral responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so that's really a different way of looking at classroom right. management. And again, it's that was an issue that clearly culture impacts in terms of classroom management.
Mm-hmm. Very, very good. What were some of the lessons then from maybe the American teachers that you thought were sort of interesting or innovative? I know you had a couple that you listed.
Yeah. So with U.S. teachers, they certainly would, kind of like with teachers, person get to know their students and build relationships, and that was important in terms of classroom management. And of course, one teacher actually, when the kids came in to the room was completely blank. There was nothing on the walls. Mm-hmm. It was bare. Yeah. And he told them, this is your room.
Right.
This is your room. And you're going to help to create this room. Now, you know, that's just amazing and actually quite innovative in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Typically, when kids come in, it's all decorated. Right. They've got their names on their desks.
Yep.
You know, the teacher has taken the whole thing. But this teacher, trying to build a sense of community, mm-hmm. which impacts management, said, this is your room. This is our room. And mm-hmm. we're going to create it together, which was quite an innovative approach. And it really worked for him.
Okay. Yeah, very, very nice. And you kind of close this chapter and open the next chapter with this nice nice little Chinese poem, or this at least, you know, one sentence from this poem. The spring rain moistens things silently.
Yes.
And I think it's a nice, lovely, little kind of a metaphor for teaching, at least the way you use it. Can you kind of talk about your lessons learned and what sort of this impact from this study will have? And just for the listeners, the metaphor is talking about how teaching can really change things, but very sort of delicately and sort of influences students much more slowly than maybe you might expect.
Yes, this was quite an interesting metaphor. And one of the questions we asked all teachers that we interviewed was to create a metaphor that explains how they think about teaching mm-hmm. and being a teacher. And this was quite illuminating. As we know, metaphors can really help us to understand how folks are thinking about things. And this metaphor was really about that, and as you indicated, the spring rain moistens things silently, that education, it really was an element of being. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that you just go to school and all of a sudden you're being educated. Mm-hmm. That it permeates every part of our lives. And so for that reason, we come to it ready to kind of soak it up and be ready to engage in it. And so every aspect of the day is about learning. And indeed, you know, with kids in China and in some of the areas in the countryside, the kids actually lived at the school because they lived so far away from the school. And so learning occurred all throughout the day and into the evening and was a part of just what they did. That it was, that really learning is a virtue. Mm-hmm. And that's how it was approached, that learning is a virtue. In addition, in the front of the book, in the acknowledgments, we have this picture of a flower that's endemic to China called winter sweet. Mm-hmm. And a middle school math teacher had prepared, when she would prepare work to pass out to her students, she always had a picture of this flower on the front. And she said that the flower blooms in winter, and in Chinese culture, it's a symbol of bravery, integrity, and perseverance. Mm-hmm. And she said it communicates that teachers have high expectations for their students, that you're going to have challenges, but you can beat that challenge and bloom even in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. And so really looking at learning again as a virtue, something to be applauded and celebrated, again, the responsibility of the student.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I love at the, you know, one of the last sort of figures or charts that you have in the book just lays out all of the different characteristics and sort of what are the similarities and then what are the differences between between Chinese and American teachers, or at least these American teachers, which I think is a really great, maybe a visual to everyone just to kind of look. And so I suggest the readers to go check that out for sure. One of the things you guys do include is this cultural context section as well. Can you kind of talk about what you found through there and why you guys use that, why you guys use this in the book? You know, for instance, you know, collectivism versus individuality, masculine versus feminine, uncertainty avoidance, and sort of long-term orientation. Can you kind of talk about, you know, what that meant and sort of how that related to the study?
Sure. Well, you know, when we think about and when countries are compared in terms of PISA studies, a question that's always asked as well, or a comment that's typically made as well, the culture is different. Mm. Does that really impact what happens in terms of education? I think intuitively we know that it does. But we, with another colleague from South China Normal University, we've been conducting some research with the PISA studies and looking at the impact of culture on how students are performing across countries. And so this initial study was really just a correlation, a simple correlation, and we've been working on a more robust statistical analysis as of late, and so are working on writing that up right now. But looking at, and these are the cultural dimensions that you mentioned are from Geert Hofstede, who's a and he developed these cultural dimensions, and they've been researched quite extensively. In looking at, if we look at math, science, et cetera, those PISA scores, do we see a correlation with countries that have high long-term orientation or avoiding of uncertainty, that kind of thing?
Right.
And certainly you can read more about those dimensions in the book or from the Hofstede Center. And what we found was that of all the cultural dimensions, the one that seems to bubble up as being most highly correlated and in our latest study, most significantly predictive of student achievement is long-term orientation.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So what that means is that, and it makes sense if you look at the countries that have the highest long-term orientation cultural value, it is the East Asian countries that I'm engaged in this learning. Learning is a virtue. I persevere, and there will be a long-term benefit, something later on down the road. versus in other countries where there's a short-term orientation. And the U.S. Has a shorter-term orientation in terms of, and you think about that, you know, in our corporations, the boards want to see a quick return. We want to see our companies do well quickly. The same in education. We want to see improvement in student achievement in a year. You know, where a principal will come into a school that's not been doing well, and they're given a year to turn it around. Mm-hmm. And that's short-term orientation, that we want to see results, and we want to see it now.
Right.
And versus long-term orientation, that eventually we'll get there, and that we need to look for what's the value of what we're doing right now. How can we persevere and make it through to that next stage in our learning? And so that was an interesting difference and could, in fact, be explanatory of some of the differences that we found among teachers, especially in terms of that classroom management piece and students' responsibility to be engaged and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. That's, and you also, you know, beyond that, you sort of get into Confucian values, Western values, which I think is interesting. To this book as well, but is there any sort of final thought or takeaway that you want to share with our listeners from the book?
I think that a lot of times we're dismissive of what folks in other countries are doing, and I think that's we need to be cautious about that because education is education. And even though that educational systems operate within cultures, that there are some things that cross the cultural divide. And I think that we need to be open in the U.S. To strategies that are being used in classrooms in other countries and how that they could help inform what we're doing with our students as well. And so I think a big takeaway is that I saw some great lessons in China and I saw some great lessons in the U.S. Teachers who are highly committed to their work, sure that they may have been approached differently, and that approach is something that we can learn from. And one example I would give you is how we engage in professional development. In the U.S., it's where, you know, this week, for example, in some areas, teachers are back, but kids aren't. And this is a week for PD, for professional development. And then kids come and we go on our merry way. We've done our day of professional development. We check off that box. In China, it was more integrated into their daily work, where they, you know, engage in, most folks probably have heard of lesson study, where they create a lesson together, they go and observe one another, then they talk about it. So it's really embedded in their daily practice rather than a day where we go and we hear somebody talk or listen to some new strategy. And then once kids come, we get so busy and we might have thought, yeah, that's something interesting I might like to do. Right. But kids come and it's just, you know, you just get busy.
Absolutely.
So again, I think that we need to be open and to learn from others and think about how that we can continue to address the needs of students within the U.S. And again, also in China, interested in addressing needs of their students by looking at how others are approaching education. And I think looking not only at educational systems broadly, but getting down into what is actually happening in the classroom. And I think that's what this book did, is, you know, when we talk about differences in educational systems, differences in cultures, but when you really get down and you sit in classrooms, you know, that there is a lot of a common approach, but certainly things that we can learn from one another in approaching education.
Fantastic. Well, I know you know, this book is fresh off the presses and probably still on your mind, and you mentioned some of the stuff coming up, but what do you got next on your plate?
Well, quite busy. I'll actually be, heading to to Taipei in China here in about a week.
Fantastic.
Working with teachers and then lecturing at a university on some of our work. And then also engaging in a project where we have some pre-service teachers coming over from Shanghai. Mm-hmm. And I'll be working with some folks in Michigan. And we're going to have a day of pre-service teachers of U.S. and China pre-service teachers working together and discussing approaches to lessons and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But in terms of research, we're continuing our work and actually interested in approaching educating students who may be at risk or come from populations that are not performing as well. China is very interested in their minority population.
Yes.
They have a vast number of ethnic minorities, mm-hmm. Who may live right on the border of China. And so they're highly interested in how we approach their needs. And so we're going to be engaging with continued study in great teachers who work with students who are from these ethnic minorities and what is it that they do with these students. So this will be a continued collaboration between College of William & Mary and Yunnan Normal University.
Yeah, okay. We'll definitely be looking forward to that. It's, you know, sounds like it's all very interested and quite connected to what you have written out here. So, all right, thank you to all my listeners. Thank you, Dr. Leslie Grant, and please go check out West Meets East, Best Practices from Expert Teachers in the United States and China. So that'll be it. And go follow us on Twitter at newbooks.edu. Dr. Grant, do you have a Twitter that you'd like to plug here? Or?
No, I haven't gotten on that quite yet, so I don't have a Twitter account.
All right. Well, that's all right for all our listeners. I hope you learned something. Thank you.